This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. So many jobs in this economy, so few takers, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 8th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This might not sound like a lot to the casual consumer of business and economic news, but believe me when I tell you that the fact that there were 11 million job openings in this economy as July came to a close, it's kind of amazing. It's an all-time high, also about 750,000 more job openings than there were at the end of June. So we learned today from the monthly job openings and labor turnover survey, JOLTS in the lingo, produced courtesy of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But at the same time, that is July, the number of hires, workers actually hired into jobs, stayed pretty much the same. So what's up with that? Marketplace's Samantha Fields gets us going.
There's a lot going on in the labor market right now. A lot of flux, a lot of churn, a lot of uncertainty. Annalise Goger at the Brookings Institution says it's not exactly a labor shortage.
It's like a real mismatch in where the jobs are and where the qualified people with experience are.
In some sectors, there aren't enough job openings, construction, education, and the arts. And in others, there are too many, healthcare and retail and food service.
An employer doesn't just want any worker. They're trying to fit the candidate with what the job entails. And likewise, a worker doesn't want just any job.
With so many openings and so many people looking, she says, it's kind of inevitable that it'll take a while for everyone to find the right fit. On top of that,
we are still at the whims of the pandemic.
Nick Bunker is an economist at Indeed, which is a marketplace underwriter. He says there are still a lot of people who aren't ready to take jobs yet because of COVID or childcare issues or both. And there are also signs in job posting data from August on Indeed that employers in some sectors are starting to pull back.
Sectors that are really sensitive to the pandemic. So food service, so that's lots of restaurant and bar jobs. Also childcare.
Still, there was a record number of open jobs at the end of July. Erica Groshen, the former commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says if employers are having trouble hiring, they should ask themselves some questions.
Are the wages as high as they need to be? Are the benefits appropriate? What about their working conditions?
And, she says, are they maybe passing people over who have the skills they're looking for, but not certain credentials, like a four-year college degree? I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Homeowners piled on another $1 trillion in equity in the second quarter of this year. That's from the real estate data firm Black Knight. And that is $1 trillion in just 3 months, April to June, Q2. And to boot, it's what's known as tappable equity, the amount you could cash out and still have 20% equity in the home in question. Now, yes, that is mostly paper wealth. We get that, as home prices have kept on going up at double-digit rates. But more homeowners are turning those gains into actual cash and spending it. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers real estate for us.
Between April and June, more than 1 million homeowners cashed out a collective $63 billion in home equity by refinancing.
Both of which are the highest level in nearly 15 years.
Andy Walden is vice president of market research at Black Knight.
We've seen the average home increase in value by 25% since the onset of the pandemic. So you're just seeing a boon of equity for these homeowners when you're seeing them tap into that available equity.
Black Knight doesn't track how people spend the money, but earlier this year, the consumer financial platform Credit Karma tried to find out. Among homeowners who'd tapped their equity in the past 12 months, the top three expenditures were renovations, emergency expenses, and paying down debt. Credit Karma's VP of Home, Andy Taylor, says because interest rates are so low,
you can both cash out money from your home equity, but also refinance at a better rate and have a better cash flow situation on a month-by-month basis anyways.
Rising equity also provides a cushion for people struggling to pay their mortgages. Of the 1.7 million homeowners in forbearance plans, the overwhelming majority still have at least 10% equity in their homes. Lori Goodman with the Urban Institute says that could help them hold on to their homes when those plans expire if they still can't afford their payments. And if they have to sell,
they're going to be able to sell their home in a fairly good housing market and take out that equity.
The share of homeowners who would take a loss if they had to sell because they owe more than their homes are worth is less than 1%, a record low. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of a downer, but not too bad. All in all, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. San Francisco, Berkeley, New Orleans, also New York, introduced vaccine mandates last month. New York is going to start enforcing its mandate on Monday. So if you go to a theater, a museum, an aquarium, bowling alley, gym, convention center, casino, you want to eat and drink inside a restaurant or bar, I mean, the list goes on, right? You've got to be at least partially vaccinated. As to what that looks like in actual practice, a whole lot of people, especially people who run or work at bars and restaurants, are trying to figure that out right now. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra went to Brooklyn to talk to some of them.
Sunset Park is one of those New York City neighborhoods where you could eat every meal at a different restaurant for weeks and never get tired of your options. For a 50-block stretch, you'll find soup dumplings, hand-pulled noodles, empanadas, tamales, tacos, pizza. And now you'll also find the same piece of paper taped to the doors of most of these restaurants, courtesy of the city. It says, New York City requires you to be vaccinated against COVID-19 to enter this business. But, you know, who reads those signs anyway?
We've had so many people walk into the restaurant and have no idea that it was required.
That's Linda Garcia, a waitress at El Pollo Peruano Dos, a Peruvian restaurant that serves dishes like roasted chicken and lomo saltado, a stir fry with steak. It's her job to break the news to customers.
So we usually ask them, is it for dine-in or takeout? And whenever they say dine-in, we ask them if we could see their vaccination card before they enter.
And that's where things can get a little sticky. Some people are cool with it. They say it makes the restaurant feel safer. That's how Garcia feels, too. Others give her a hard time. The day I visit, it's 95 degrees.
The weather's been crazy hot outside lately, and people sometimes want to stay inside and eat where there's fresh air conditioner and stuff.
It's hard to be the one telling them no. Mario Subia struggles with that, too. He's a server at a Mexican restaurant down the street called Maria's Bistro Mexicano. Inside, its brick walls are draped with brightly colored textiles and pictures of Frida Kahlo and La Virgen de Guadalupe.
You know, like, it's the rules of the rules. I don't want to ask you if you got it or not. I don't really even care. But I'm like, if my boss says you can't come in if you don't got it, like, what do you, like, I'm sorry.
The way some people react makes them feel bad.
Seeing their resentment and they're like, you know, I won't come here. Then. I'm like, we're losing a customer, but what can I do?
The other thing that's hard about this, he's not sure how to tell if a vaccine card or a picture of a vaccine card is real. He's just been winging it.
I got one so I know what mine looks like.
And then it's like, do you have to check IDs along with the vaccination card? Yes, according to the city's guidance about the vaccine mandate published online. But a lot of bar and restaurant workers haven't gotten that message. There's also a vaccination verification app created by the state called the Excelsior Pass. People are still figuring out how to use that, too. When I walk into a fancy cocktail bar down the block called Loren, the owner and bartender, Travis Claus, asks to see my proof of vaccination. I open the app, which decides to update itself at that very moment. So we wait.
Okay, here we go.
Then Claus thinks maybe there's a QR code he needs to scan with his phone.
I'm thinking I need to, like, scan it and then check this and go back with the ID.
But all the app shows is my name, birth date, and an expiration date set a year after I got my second dose.
Oh, yeah, there's no code there. Okay, all right. So, yeah, I guess that's it.
Later, I realized I just needed to tap on the screen and the QR code would appear. This is not something you can expect a busy bartender to do, customer by customer, on a weekend. So Claus just hired someone to stand at the door a few days a week for $20 an hour and check people's vaccination status. There is a workaround for customers who say no. They can drink their cocktails outside.
I have some people, you know, some of my regulars who don't want to get vaccinated that won't come in anymore. Like, I actually have one of my guys out there right now who's, you know, a total gentleman, but he really doesn't want to be vaccinated. And so he's just going to hang outside from now on.
After we're done talking, I approach two customers sitting out there on benches on opposite sides of the door. One says he's in favor of the mandate. The other doesn't want to talk about it. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
People in this economy who need help making their rent have gotten kind of a double whammy the past couple of weeks. The Supreme Court overturned President Biden's evictions ban, and in some, really many parts of the country, the distribution of some $50 billion in rent relief money has been going, well, shall we just say, slowly. So we got Jessica Thomason on the phone to talk about what's going on. She's the Executive Policy Director of North Dakota's Department of Human Services. Ms. Thomason, welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
Nice to be here.
Why, and I'm going to ask you to speak sort of maybe outside just North Dakota, but the larger question seems to be, why is this so hard? And I wonder what you're seeing.
Part of the challenge with delivering emergency rent assistance in this period of time is that you're trying to connect two parties. You're trying to connect that renter who's experiencing housing crisis with a housing provider who is obviously experiencing disruption and need of their own, and making sure that you're getting the right dollars to the right people in the right time and that they meet basic eligibility criteria that have been established by the federal government. And you need to do all of that very quickly, typically in systems that haven't been designed to do this. So it, even though conceptually it seems like something that should be kind of easy to achieve, it's been a logistical challenge to make sure that you get all the pieces working together at the right time.
How much longer do you suppose, rather, it might take before we have this running smoothly? I mean, there are eviction moratorium expiring, there are benefits going away, all of those things.
You know, I actually think we're seeing signs of that right now. I think these last several months, I know in our state and I know in others as well, people have been working really hard on fine-tuning what outreach looks like. It sounds mm-hmm. counterintuitive, but a lot of times people just self-filter out. They think they don't qualify. They think they didn't really experience a hardship because maybe they didn't, you know, lose their job or receive unemployment directly. But in fact, they did experience a hardship. And a lot of households are struggling even more now. And I think it's really just helping them understand what the opportunity is for them to get back on their feet by participating in this emergency rent assistance program. So I think we're starting to see the benefits. I hope we all are. I wish it was faster, but I think we're starting to see it.
You used an interesting word, outreach. Those of us who follow the news closely or who are in the news business have known about these programs. Not everybody is as glued to, you know, their phones or laptops or what have you. And I imagine you have to do a certain amount of marketing to make sure people know that these programs are available.
More than any of us expected, I would say, and I guess I'll speak only for myself, but we're a state that is largely rural. It takes a real concerted effort to make sure that people understand that this is something that's worth their time to make this application and to try to get some help.
Is there opportunity here, and I'm sure you've explored this, for community-based organizations, public-private partnerships, those kinds of things, because what you have here is a communications problem, not a, you know, let's write the checks problem.
Yeah, 100%. We're really seeing that in North Dakota, we're calling it an application counselor network. So we're working with community-based organizations across the state who are that in-community, in-person, or over the phone or email or text, whatever it takes, connection for somebody who might be struggling to get all the way through the process. And it's that connecting point that we think is going to make all the difference and then allow us to make sure that we process whatever comes in the door as quickly as we can to connect that assistance to the people who need it.
Take a step back and frame this in terms of the North Dakota economy, and people can make their own inferences based on the national economy, but people not getting rent assistance aren't able to concentrate at work. They can't make those wages. They can't get groceries. They can't do all of those things that trickle down into the larger economy, right?
I think for all of us during the pandemic, it's become more and more apparent that for you to be actively engaged in the workforce, you have to have some amount of stability in your everyday life, whether that's childcare, family caregiving responsibilities, or stable housing. I think we are all coming to understand that this is directly connected to your ability to remain engaged in the workforce, which is, it's what people want to do. It's how you make your household budget work.
Jessica Thomason, she is the Executive Policy Director at the North Dakota Department of Human Services. Ms. Thomason, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Coming up.
You know, at the end of the day, more water is good for me.
Water, water everywhere can be good for business. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 68 points today, 0.2%, 35,031. The NASDAQ declined 87 points, about a half percent, 15,286 there. The S&P 500 off 5 points, about a tenth percent, 45.14. Another deal in the buy now, pay later sector of financial products to tell you about. PayPal says it's snapping up a Japanese company called PayD. It's a deal valued at $2.7 billion. It's going to help PayPal increase its presence in Asia. No word on whether PayPal is doing this on an installment plan. Installment plan. See what I did there? Told you last month about another buy now, pay later deal. Payment tech company Square is acquiring Australian fintech company Afterpay. Remember that one? Anyway, PayPal shares down 2.7%. You'll be forgiven if you don't remember that Square deal. Bonds, they rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down 1.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, A higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. More people in this economy are working longer, well into their 60s. Some of them of necessity, some by choice, but that's been a trend for a good couple of decades now. There is some data out, though, from the New York Federal Reserve this week that shows change may be a-coming. In its July labor market survey, the New York Fed says 50.1% of people expect to keep working past the age of 62. That is an almost 2 percentage point drop from a year ago. And expectations people have that they're going to be working past 67, well, they fell as well. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that one.
Each recession comes with its own obstacles for older Americans. The last one is depicted in the movie Nomadland. Frances McDormand plays a widow puzzling together work at Amazon fulfillment centers and beet processing plants.
You may want to consider early retirement.
I need work. I like work.
If a movie is made about the pandemic recession, well,
it's probably going to be called something like The Tale of Two Retirements.
Teresa Ghilarducci is a labor economist at the New School. She says some older workers have the room to retire thanks to savings or because their retirement accounts got a boost. She says about 10% of older Americans have this kind of financial stability. Then there's everyone else. Some need to work, but feel there aren't jobs for them.
Some of that, the expectations that they can't work past 62 or 65 might be more pessimistic because of reality.
She says the pandemic has only reinforced older Americans' sense that they're not valued. They were laid off or quit because they were at higher risk for COVID. In August, nearly half of job seekers 55 or older were long-term unemployed, compared to about a third for younger workers. That's according to AARP, where David John is a senior policy advisor.
That means that these people are going to have a much more problematic retirement.
They'll be more likely to dip into savings and Social Security early and face a gap in health insurance.
Also, it's going to be a matter of deciding what standard of living they can actually live with and adapting to that.
John says it's common for people's financial expectations of retirement to not match the reality. But reality has never quite looked like this. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I saw on the weather today that there's another storm coming to New York City. That is quite possibly the last thing that city needs. More rain, the prospect of more flooding, even as it and communities and industries that were in Hurricane Ida's path are still setting things right. So we've gotten Austin Golding on the phone down in Vicksburg, Mississippi, where he runs the Golding Barge Line. It is one of those industries where the weather can be a big factor. Hey, Austin, how are you?
Hey, Kai, doing wonderful. How you doing?
I'm all right. But I have to tell you, when I heard that storm was coming through, and maybe this is me being too close to my sources, not the first thing, but one of the things I thought of was, man, I wonder how Vicksburg's doing. So you guys, did you do all right?
Oh, yeah. We were lucky to be on the west side of it. So all that dry air that kind of cooled it off once it got into the mid part of Mississippi, we barely had any rain. It was nuts.
Wow. But I mean, I heard from the Corps of Engineers, like the Mississippi River reversed itself. Did that not hit you?
It did, yeah. It did down around Baton Rouge, so, right, you know, probably 200 or 300 miles south of here. And it wrecked probably 300 to 400 barges and a couple dozen boats, at least. No injuries or deaths, which was pretty unbelievable. But the hurricane came through in a path that was almost perfect to disrupt the lower Mississippi River right around New Orleans area. I don't think we've ever seen anything like it.
You know, it strikes me that your company and your whole industry is part of the infrastructure that is going to be affected by climate change most immediately, right? I mean, all businesses are going to have to deal with it. You, though, I mean, it's literally a structural issue for you, and you've got to be taking that into consideration as you plan, you know, the next 10, 15 years of your business.
We are, you know, and I think, you know, an interesting debate that broke out around this where, you know, the $15 billion that were spent on the flood walls and everything that was put in place to protect New Orleans, it worked. But $15 billion is a lot of money. And, you know, if that's the type of price tag it's going to take for these coastal communities to live through climate change, there's going to be some that can foot the bill, but a lot that many that can't. Mm-hmm. Luckily, on the inland side where boats and barges are, we haven't seen anything in our infrastructure that's been disrupted totally by climate change. And, you know, at the end of the day, more water is good for me. and you know, it comes with pluses and minuses, but if it takes $15 billion to protect an area that we operate in, you just got to wonder how much that investment can be replicated in places that aren't so fortunate or don't have as many eyeballs on them.
Yeah, a lot of eyeballs down there. All right, different topic, but same general thrust. How's the pandemic treating Golden Barge Lines? I mean, are you guys busy? Is it? What are you seeing?
Our market is still significantly off. Volumes are not back in the petroleum world where they were, and there's some volume that may have gone away completely. So still down, and probably most day-to-day pertinent challenge is trying to push vaccine and push safety measures and still try to message on COVID so we have healthy crews and a healthy workforce. That's been a real challenge for us.
Well, yeah, say more about that, because I was looking back over our past couple of interviews, and I think three in a row now we've talked about staffing and the challenges you're having. Still the case? Still happening?
Still the case. You know, naturally, we met that challenge with a small wage increase, but just like we talked about, our business isn't back, so that's kind of counterintuitive, but we had to do it. But second of all, you know, we've seen a push, an increase in the amount of COVID cases, which makes it harder to crew. In our office here, we're 100% vaccinated. On board, we're probably closing in on 60 to 65% vaccinated, and we're trying to push as many as we can voluntarily to get it. It's good for business, but it's good for our employees, and it's something a good business owner with strong moral standard needs to be a proponent of.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. But let me be clear. You're pushing, but you're not mandating, right?
We haven't mandated yet. Yeah. And so far, I see us continuing to gain ground without said mandate. Now, I'll also be the first one to tell you that if we mandated it, we would have several employees run to places that don't take COVID as serious as we do.
Yep.
And I would love to have an easy peasy, easy button mandate, but we don't have that route available to us, so we're making the most of what leverage we do have.
Austin Golding, he runs family business down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. It's called Golding Barge Lines. Austin, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you. We'll check in soon, huh?
Thanks, Kyle. All my best.
You too. This final note on the way out today, which I am reasonably sure actually is this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. Tesla was granted a patent yesterday, patent number 11,110,896, if you want to look it up. Here is the title, Pulsed Laser Cleaning of Debris Accumulated on Glass Articles in Vehicles and Photovoltaic Assemblies. Lasers. Elon Musk is going to use lasers as windshield wipers. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context on the way out. Comes courtesy of one Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America. In a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer today about the debt limit, Yellen said that by mid-October-ish, she is going to be out of couch cushions in which to find money to fund the federal government. And this is a quote, a delay that calls into question the federal government's ability to meet all its obligations would likely cause irreparable damage to the U.S. economy and global financial markets. And yet, here we are. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Scolacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Rebecca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.